This is the third and final of a series called The Helping Professions Hurt. Can helping professionals be safe? The obvious answer, which all of you know, is yes. But they are saved by grace and not over here. By their work in the professions. But we'll get into that. See, yesterday we talked about these two worlds, and one world we are familiar with. We've been educated in it, raised in it. It's the institutional world, and increasingly our lives, our jobs, our recreation are in that world. Another world we have a fondness for, it's the world of community, of association, of stories, of the civic. This world is managed, services are commodified, education is curricularized. This other world is unmanaged, uncommodified, uncurricularized. There was a time when politics was in this other world. We thought of the town meeting, or of the ward, or the civic association, or the public square, the local discussion, and we were talking a little bit about that last night. But now politics takes place, institutionalized off through the television set. Some people say, and this we got to clear, that this other world, this world of community, of association, of caring, is the world of the small and the intimate and the face-to-face. And therefore, we're just nostalgic and romantic for the good old days, especially those of us who are in cities all the time, are just longing for the lost vision of rural America where that happened. No, this other world's not always the small. In fact, it's the many, and it's the diverse. In languages and in styles. In fact, this world eliminates diversity. Claims to give us choice. That's what modern society does. And I'm thinking sometimes when I travel and the choice is between TWA and Southwest Airlines, and you get inside, and of course they all are alike. And you get to the city, and you have a choice, and you can go to Holiday Inn, or Travel Lodge, or Motel 6, or whatever. And you get inside the room, and they are all, you could not tell one motel room from another, because they are all the same. And you turn on your TV set. And you get ABC and NBC and CBS. And unless they told you what they were, you wouldn't know one from another. So that this institutional world claims to give us choice and diversity. But my guess is diversity really exists in this other world. So I think it is not simply a nostalgic for a lost America. Now the conclusion yesterday was that as institution expands, community shrinks. Now it sounded like I was blaming professional helpers for this, and let's correct that. I think we are simply participants going along in this world that the danger is in our work is that we think of ourselves as really helpers, as really caring, as really doing good. That's what led us into these helping professions. We didn't want to make things that people would consume and throw away. We wanted to serve people and to help people with their problems. That's why I thought Val's story last night was reflective of many of our stories. We want to heal. We want to bring justice. So if we want to bring justice, we go into law. If we want to heal, we go into medicine. And if we want to share learning, we go into teaching. And the way we get into those professions is to go through a credentialized process that prepares us for this world, that makes teaching into a curricularized commodity where we no longer are, in fact, we aren't allowed to care for students and to share in their agonies. And it also sometimes makes health care into a commodity where, because I was on the board of a neighborhood health center, and they said that only 10 minutes per patient for the doctor, or else we just can't make our ends meet. And so how can the doctor find out a history? How can the helper find out the story of the person so that they can say, no, tell me your symptoms, not your stories. And so we sometimes doctors get frustrated, teachers get frustrated, social workers get frustrated because they came into their work out of ideals of wanting to help and to serve, and they end up in institutions that turn it into a commodity. And graduate schools, and we could spend some time on that, those of us who have been into professional schools of any kind, Take those of us who come from the local and the caring and association and turn us into people that will fit into and play roles in institutions that are managed, commodified, and curricularized. And I want to tell a story now in a way that links what I was talking about last week when I was spent, for those of you who have weren't here last week, I spent the week talking primarily about Guatemala, that I know a little about, not much, and I was down there in April, and we have had two Guatemalan families living in our community in Sanctuary. And it was learning from them and from reading about Rigoberto Menchú, her book, on that I get this story. And it's from the village. They were both Nicolas Gonzalez, who's in Sanctuary with us, and Rigoberto Menchú, who's sort of the leader of in exile of Guatemalan campesinos, came from Uspantan in Quiché, and they were both Mayan Indians. And they tell how the Mayans lived for centuries off the land with rice and beans and corn, and they took care of the land and of each other, and they speak eloquently about how that happened. And the Europeans came with an idea that of land ownership, and they were able to remove the Indians from the land and own the land to produce coffee and cotton and bananas. But they gave, they permitted the Indians to have small, the Mayans to have small plots of land, which each of them were to own individually. and those small plots were not large enough to permit them to grow enough to sustain themselves. So they all had to work at the large plantations 4, 5, 6 months a year in order to stay alive. And this system of almost slave labor and of teaching the indigenous that they should each own a plot of land continued. And then a new group, small group of Europeans came, men and women from the church, and said, in the past we told you to be obedient. In the church, we said that you were meant to be poor and that you would get your reward in heaven. And but we are now revealing to you the book, which we, because Vatican II said we could do this, we are now revealing to you the book which we never let you have before. And this book tells about good news to the poor and the release to the captives and liberty to the oppressed. And they began to read this book, and they saw that they didn't have to be managed and controlled. And some of the elders remembered how they used to live before, and they organized cooperatives and they developed associations and they put their land together. And they started to work to get clean water so the children wouldn't die. And they found they were able to get by in this recovering of this community again so that they didn't have to work on the plantations. And that was a joy. And then, of course, you know what happened. They were labeled as subversive. They were labeled as communist. They killed 15 of the priests. They, meaning the Guatemalan government. They captured and tortured the catechists, hundreds of them, and the health workers. They killed. They drove the base communities underground, these communities, and they bombed the villages. U.S. came along again and said in the last few years, we will help you. We will give you aid, AID, an official program, assistance of international development. Mm-hmm. We will help you develop. And we said, it's too bad what happened in the early 80s. But we will teach you now a new technology. And we met with the ambassador and his economic and aid advisors. And he said, we will teach you how to grow broccoli. And because we need broccoli, and you can buy, then with the money, you can buy your rice and beans. What Nicholas and Rigoberto and others began to say to us, because we said, no more aid. Of course, no more military aid, but no more development. No more, because all aid means, all your help means is expansion of this system. Give us one thing, land. We don't want your help, we want the land, because that is power. Well, this is a story in another context of another way of an expansion of a managed, controlled system destroying a community. It happens differently in our setting. I preached a sermon, I think last year. The pastor didn't want to put it up on the title on the sign in front of the church. But I persuaded him that he could do it. And the title was, Love is a Subversive Activity. Because it became clear in Guatemala that love is a subversive activity. In fact, it is clear in most places in the world, many places in the world, that love is a subversive activity. But here, we have placed love over in the institution and made it into a commodity called service. Okay. And so, many of us who are motivated by care and concern end up being trained and credentialized to be administrators of love, which becomes commodified into some kind of service. And what we think of is, if we are to love people more, it means more service, more professionals, more help. Well, let me then just now shift gears and indicate a couple of suggestions, and then find more specific suggestions from all of you. What can we do to help protect, to help sustain the world of the community? One is to take off the mask. If we have and sometimes we call that demystifying or demythologizing. We create myths about ourselves, that we are more virtuous, more wise, more loving than perhaps we really are, that many of us are guided more by self-interest than we would like to admit. Some of the myths we create around the world are very demonic myths we create ourselves. Southern Africa, we see some extremely demonic myths. If we demythologize, we will not confuse service with care. We certainly not confuse legal help with justice. And not confuse necessarily medicine with health. But what happens? We mystify. One of the ways of mystification, and Jody brought that to my attention yesterday, is the whole realm of developing special languages. That most graduate school is basically language school. I was talking to lawyers, and they said basically they spent a couple of years just learning a legal language that a lot of people could do what lawyers do, because it's trying to make, you know, help people settle things, but you develop a very legal language. And of course, sociologists develop, we all develop our jargon of the language of our profession. So developing special languages, labeling, right, shorthand way of designating people, certification, a way of entering into this system. So what they're saying is, one way we can be subversive, so we're talking about how can we be subversive. If that is our goal, and if love is subversive, how can we be subversive? And that is, would be stop labeling people. And the handicapped have tried to draw this to our attention for a long time, of the dangers of labeling. We could stop mystifying people with language. Of course, sometimes we keep that language because that's the only thing we have that separates us, so that we can drop the language. I remember, and of course, a lot of physicians began doing, drop some of the symbols. They would no longer wear the white coats in the offices. They just wear ordinary clothes like some of the patients, so that you couldn't tell the physician from the patient sometimes in some of the doctor's offices. And that made some patients very some very upset. And of course, many physicians have been trying to change the language by which they so they can communicate. Some have even said we should drop certification. Now that gets scary. You drop certification, then you ask around, who is it that helps people? Well, maybe it's someone who rubs somebody else's back and they felt a lot better. Or maybe it's someone who has some advice on herbs and still remembers how to combine some herbs. And maybe there's a lot of ways, there are a lot of healers around. But right now there's been a monopoly of healers and under allopathic medicine. But maybe we could begin to drop labeling, certification, and esoteric language, and that would be subversive. Another thing we might think of is that we would not substitute service for social change. You see, our response to problems is more service, more aid, more help. We would begin to think that maybe changing thing means redistribution. Francis Moore LePay, and author of Diet for a Small Planet, and sort of one of the most thoughtful people behind Food First, observed more food, this and in the hunger area, this is clear. More food, or even redistribution programs like food aid and food stamps, will continue to mean more hunger until we first address the question of who controls and who takes part in the production process. So a lot of time or inclination, people are hungry, let's give them food. But Guatemala, they say, hey, give us some land. We'll take care of the food. Teach them, don't give them fish, teach them how to fish kind of thing. So there you're asking for, if we want to help, look at the structures of power and control in society. And if justice more than service is our goal, and I think that's why some of us get in this, because out of love we see the inequities, and if justice is more, then we might think that our real goal is organizing. Because the difference between an organizer who organizes people's capacities, a servant sort of fills their deficiencies. So in much of our work, we might think of organizing especially those who are powerless, who are marginalized. What they need is power. That's what I was saying the other day. What they're saying for, how can we help? Give us that one thing that makes you strong, not your knowledge, but your legitimation, your authority, and your power. You can keep the rest. This, and many of the professions are talking, and we can think more of what empowerment means. To helping professions and what it would change. And of course, the final thing I just want to say, and then let's talk about the one thing, is to think of many of the alternative understandings and expressions of care and of help. And these have taken many forms in the last 10 years. The growth of the self-help groups who do not have professionals, hypoglycemics, meeting together, say, talk to each other, what helped you? Because so many of the doctors said, you know, they come in, they say, I'm exhausted. And doctors might give one thing or another. And so hypoglycemics began to get together and talk and share what has helped maintain blood sugar levels. Friends of cancer victims began to meet together. And so there was a time when the only self-help group was Alcoholics Anonymous. And now there's hundreds of self-help. And mutual, they should be called probably mutual help groups. If Schumacher's book, Small is Beautiful, introduced a whole new area of appropriate technology and alternative communities, holistic health centers, we'll talk about more this afternoon, and everything from recycling, rooftop gardens, to community radio stations, learning exchanges, a variety of ways. Learning exchanges are fascinating. Rather than, you know, have a school, they put notices up, they trade, someone knows Spanish, the other one knows guitar, and they'll say, I'll teach you one, you teach me the other. And these kind of, various kind of networking where people teach each other. And I know in our urban studies program, we find that the students are a rich resource of teaching each other, and they find it hard to think of themselves as teachers because they've been through high school and 2 years of college, and we try to structure where they begin to teach each other. And I find they know more because I'm in one place, I have one student who's tutoring in Cook County Jail and another who's a community organizer and another at some agency, and when they come back to the seminar, they have so much rich knowledge that I don't have. And they are first distrustful or amazed to think that I really want to find out. They think I'm sort of asking a question so they'll start talking. And it takes them a while to think that I really want to find out what they know, because they can teach me some things. Then they begin to teach each other. So there's processes where we can begin to recover. John McKnight told, Forgotten Tools. John McKnight tells the story, I still remember, he tells it about a woman in 1950 who for some strange reason wanted to breastfeed her child. And she couldn't find anybody to teach her how to get the milk flowing. And she realized that for a generation, the official line of pediatricians had been that this is bad for children, that you are not being a responsible mother, and so on and so forth, that everybody, virtually everybody, bottle-fed babies because it was better. But she found someone who remembered how to help her breastfeed, and the two of them found what has become La Leche League, which is now an international group of probably more than anything else, led to the kind of recovery of breastfeeding, so that a decade ago, certifying medical groups said this is the preferred way. But it was a kind of example of a recovery of a almost lost, the professionals had almost taken over a kind of communal bonding tool, you would call it, of childbearing, which is recast. Well, the question is, how do we recover some of the space? And a lot of us are concerned about that because it is that foot that we have, if we have foot in both worlds, that led us into the helping professions. And so, let me conclude with that. How do we break, in some ways, the domination? How do we become subversive, basically, of the expanding institutional world? And maybe we can share and teach each other, because a lot of you know, I'm just fascinated by being up at Holden, because probably here is where that is practiced. Because in the city, the garbage is taken out by this institution, by waste management. And here you begin to think differently about our waste. Well, what, how can we help Val get tenure in this system and still, or, you see, some have said, I can't stay in this system. If I really want to care for people and do what led me, I've got to find some alternative. But there are things you could do in this system. I just want to have one other small story. Quentin Young, a friend of mine, became medical director of Cook County Hospital. And, I mean, this was a kind of strange step because Quentin had gone to Hanoi when Hanoi was the enemy. He'd gone down to Cuba. He organized a medical committee for human rights. They figured, finally, this is how we'll handle the radical. We'll put him in charge of one of these institutions. And to everybody's surprise, he took the appointment. And one of the things, he took the door, actually physically, he took the door off his office because, so that there, but one thing he did, one of the first things he did was try to eliminate as much as possible the flow of drugs in Cook County Hospital. Cook County Hospital, overcrowded, didn't have enough nurses. When you don't have enough nurses and you have all these screaming patients, what you do is you sedate them. And then they sort of lie in their beds, and that way you could manage the hospital. One way to manage, but you, the trouble is you couldn't find out what was wrong with them. They couldn't tell you their stories. They couldn't tell you what they hurt. They were so, and it was so easy to prescribe. And also there were detailed men in the hospital all the time, the pushers, working for Upjohn and all the companies, and they were explaining how the virtues of all these drugs. And so Cook County Hospital became just, he said he was appalled by how much drug. So then a doctor had, you had to have three doctors and two nurses or something like that signed for any and use of the drugs. And so he developed a little system, what really cut down radically. And then the nurses started complaining that they had a lot more work to do, and he tried to work with that. But he, it was a way of humanizing again Cook County Hospital, so people had to relate to each other. So there are, and I began to think, you know, there are things you can do. They may be small in some of these institutions, but that's a sidetrack. We might ask, either way, what are some of the things that we think of? No.
John, I think one of the things that's got to happen, and I don't know how it can happen, is that the institution has got to, again, put the client first. As you mentioned in your first talk, the institution puts the welfare of the institution first most of the time, mm-hmm. serving the client. And in medicine, you know, what, you know, the biggest issue in medicine right now is healthcare costs. How do we get healthcare costs down in the community? And there's a whole bunch of ways that people are trying to do that. You know, the government's trying to do it with Medicare by putting a dollar limit on what the hospitals are paid for certain diseases. And there's HMOs trying to have prepaid health care for people so they have a confined cost no matter what happens to them. But the problem is that the institutions in both these cases remain protected because what they do is just keep people out of the hospital. Where the cost is going up. HMOs can't make it mm-hmm. if they don't keep people out of the hospital, and the name of the game with Medicare is to keep people out of the hospital. And so you're really not serving, and there's patients and clients out there who need to be in the hospital now it's tougher to allow them to be in the hospital. So that those kind of manipulations and trying to hold down healthcare costs is one issue. Isn't working because the institutions are finding ways to maintain themselves, and the pain gets passed back to the community.
Yeah.
I think one way maybe that this can happen though is by competition between institutions. If one institution is a provider of healthcare, decides that they're going to take a little bit of a financial licking and let the, and let and absorb some of those costs, mm-hmm. you can drive inter-institutional competition to benefit the community.
Okay. You're talking about then finding ways of really having choice. In other words, so many of the institutions, through their certifying process, begin to have a monopoly mm-hmm. of
right.
What is.
Right, that's happened in the airlines. The
monopoly airlines. Of defining what is medicine, monopoly of defining what is education. Yeah.
But what I see happening, as I see more competition between hospitals and services, is that it just gets more glitzy. And that we're creating needs for people. Just one example for me is the walk-in emergency room. I'm a nurse practitioner in the walk-in emergency room at the Children's Hospital, the only children's hospital in Seattle. And they're advertising. You've got this big, glitzy advertisement about what we can do in the clinic. They've got a kid with a picture of her leg in the cast. Now, I don't put kids in casts when they come into my walk-in emergency room. So they're misrepresenting what I do, as well as I will then ask people, well, where do you go for your health care? And they'll say, well, I come here. Well, that's not what health care really is all about. And so it seems like hospitals, in their effort to become competitive, are really, instead of maybe absorbing costs, they're creating things for people to do in their institutions.
Mm-hmm. This is one of the dangers. What's happened is things that start over here end up very quickly over here.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole feeling about dignity of dying and a hospice movement, and it started outside in the community. And hospitals found themselves with empty space because, and they said, well, maybe we could put a little hospice in one wing of this empty hospital. And then they had home delivery. Oh, that's a threat. Home births. That's OBGYN is big business in the hospital. That's a big, that's just turnover. Babies just keep happening. And so to have babies born in hospitals, well, you get a movement, talk about subversive, that babies don't get born in hospitals. So then the hospital said, well, we'll have a birthing center, and we'll put some pictures on the wall and lamps and a Davenport, and maybe we'll put a little kitchenette, and the husband can come in and they're caught. And they said, and we'll, right in the next room, we'll have all this emergency backup equipment to make them both feel like they're home in the community, but they also have the resources if there's an emergency. And then some wellness groups got started, and they were getting into physical fitness. And then they said, well, hospitals had all these aerobic testing systems. So the co-optation by the institutions of things that emerge on the outside and work is almost overwhelming.
One of the things I've tried to do, and I don't even know if it's helpful for people in other institutions, because I probably have more freedom in my job than many people do, but I have just decided to take responsibility for my life. And that it's true, I give grades to students, and they have to live with those grades, but I also get graded every year on a 1 to 5 scale in 3 areas. And I have decided that I'm an adult, and I've chosen the life that I've chosen, and that I have to decide really what is excellence in education, and that I can't live my life mm-hmm. crying because the dean or the president or the provost don't agree, that I have to live with myself and give myself my own grades. And I try to create a community of other people who have leanings that way. Also, I tell students what's happening, because they should know what it means for their education. when this kind of grading system goes on and faculty are pushed, students should understand what's going on. I think it's real, in some ways it's very hard to do that because we've all been educated to know what standards are and we all want to make good grades, and every institution grades people in some way. If it's not as overt as giving you a 5 or 4 or 3, still everybody gets evaluated and graded, and we're all trained to want to make the best grades, but we're all also adults and eventually must take responsibility for deciding for ourselves what excellence is and how to grade ourselves.
That's interesting. One of the biggest debates we had in the Urban Studies program was over this. We started for the first 8 years of having a non-graded program. It was pass-fail. But you really had to, I don't think we failed anybody. If you participated, you passed. You had to drop out of the program to fail. But then the deans finally said, you've got to give 2 grades out of the 4 we give. And so we were saying, do we cave in? Well, of course we caved in. They are our bosses in that sense. But then we talked to the students. We all sorts of weird things we'd do with grades. Everything from having students to grade themselves, to some of the staff take the grades seriously. Sometimes I tell people I'm going to give everybody a B. They don't like that. One time I said, I'm going to look at your grade point average because I have your transcript, and I'll give you grades that are slightly higher than your grade point average. So if you are a C student, I'll give you B's. If you're a B student, I'll give you A's. And so you can forget about that and get, because none of those are happy because they want me to evaluate. Then I say, you are going to be evaluated in your work, by each other. This is a process that goes on. But I think you're probably right, breaking away from evaluation.
Well, or being willing to set your own standards. I think it's hard for students to do that because they don't have that much experience. But one of the things that adults should bring to their job is some confidence that in fact we are capable people, that's why we have the job that we have. And so we need to trust our own instincts.
That's right. I think you can transfer to the medical field. I mean, a lot of times we've heard of patients that go back to the doctors and to ask the doctor, am I well? In other words, the patient will go back to the doctor to find out when they are healed, because the doctor tells not only what's wrong, but the doctor tells you when you are well again. And so getting responsibility to understand when we are well.
I really agree with what Val is saying, taking that responsibility and taking back one's power, really, rather than giving it over always to somebody else and not trusting that I have some resources and ability to make some decisions about myself. Mm-hmm. And I think the more we buy into the institutionalized world, the more power we give to specialists out there who somehow have an answer for me and I can't do it myself. Mm-hmm. Always giving it out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that in the education world. I'm an elementary school teacher, and a lot of my friends and colleagues are full-time elementary teachers. And in Washington State, there's been a great influence on revitalizing and reaccrediting and stiffening the credentials for being a teacher. And what I've seen happen as a result is that the colleges and universities around are just producing what easy, soft credits to the up their tuition money, and everybody's getting their easy hours on things that are impractical or just, you know, very non-stimulating, they don't even look great on a credential list, but are just filling in the chinks of some system that the legislator has institutionally mandated is going to improve education. And oftentimes, and then what happens to the bureaucracies of school districts buy into certain dog and pony shows that circulate through the state, and everybody gets their credits by attending these little workshops that are artificial and have no really connection to what is happening in classrooms. And so there's all this hoopla about a revitalized education system, but basically it was just a little shot of insulin into a system that already existed.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a cynical way.
You see, most of our efforts are to reform the institution. And often reform, and it sounds like a good word, means to expand its domination. And it means more staff, more services, more accountability, better credentialing systems, better...
A more specific credentialing system, like all teachers need master's degrees, you know. Ideally, that's fine, but then what kind of master's degree is it?
You see, one of the things that's interesting, because Chicago's facing a disaster in its public school system. They look at the expenditures in public education, on the chart, and it was going up. Then they looked at the outcome and through the standardized tests, and it was going down. So the more money they were spending, the less output they were getting. So students entered the system about at the national average. By second grade, they were slightly below national average. By fifth grade, they were almost a class behind national average. And by 12th grade, they were 2 years behind national average. So the longer they stayed in the system, the further behind they fell. Well, so then they looked at urban health systems, and they're skyrocketing. Take the same one. Skyrocketing costs of urban health, and they looked at the morbidity and mortality rates, and people were getting less healthy, spending more and more. Then they looked at the police budget, more and more policemen in Chicago, more and more, and we were less and less safe in the city. And they were looking at detention and correction, more and more on prisons and correction, and there was more and more recidivism. So somehow they began that why this was, that as they expanded and they expanded the system, and the system was always more reform. So I've often asked the students, how do you explain the larger the institution and the more money we spend on the institutions? And the answer always used to be, in the old days, hey, if there's something problem, throw more money at it, get more teachers. The outcome was reduced. And why would you think that would happen? If that is a fairly adequate.
Well, I think some of it has to do with, in certified professions, as they become more certified and more monopolistic, then you have a lot of excesses that you can't have before that. And it's the same thing with government agencies, that when they become so big and big bureaucracies, that they're more or less, they become more like monopolies in the classic sense, and have the same problems that monopolies always have. I mean, they all their resources go toward perpetuating themselves and not really to the clients.
Right, okay. Here are these students down there, and the expansion of the institution met a larger, more downtown people at the Board of Education. So 45% of the people hired by the Chicago Board of Education come in contact with students. Mm-hmm. You say, They're all curriculum specialists and janitor and heating and maintenance and all this, and it gets bigger. Then you have almost an institutional maintenance in the bureaucracy. This is what I was reading in the Perestroika. This is what they're worried about in the Soviet Union. They've got some bureaucracies. Now Gorbachev is talking, the biggest single group, of course, in the Soviet Union are people who work for the state. And Gorbachev's trying to loosen that up to bring innovation in. And they're the ones that are threatening because they built mammoth bureaucracies. Well, the same thing here, that the bureaucracies get larger and larger, but the person down here feels still alienated, treated more like a thing, and so forth. So they're suggesting. Well, in Chicago, it's got to the point where it's a disaster at the bottom, and nobody wants to add, nobody trusts the solutions of the professional educators, because we've listened to their solutions for years, and things have just gotten worse. And it's true of all big city school systems, maybe, but so they're now entertaining questions of school-based management. Each school would really have authority to, in many ways, independent, in some ways independent of downtown control. And of getting the community involved in a meaningful way in education.
Yeah, I've ever seen that in Seattle public schools, that there are certain very successful smaller schools that now in the local revised busing plan that are closing, and it's just tremendous fear and uproar in some of these small schools that have been awarded and very successful, but now because of the new institutional busing plan are being closed because they were small and supposedly inefficient, and the larger school is more efficient. And it's a hot one right now in Seattle. Mm-hmm.
I just kind of have a comment. It seems what we've come around to now is that more, which is a real surprise to me, that it sounds like now that you're coming around to the conservative ideology in the United States that is against the big welfare. Take a specific that's coming up right now. There's a movement to start nationalized child care. And I mean, it's just kind of interesting to me. I think the conservatives are against this, and most of the liberals are for it. And I guess I kind of expected this class to come around to the opposite conclusions.
That's right. Somebody said I sound just like Ronald Reagan. Children. What this means is cut out all that money for those human services. They're only destructive. And I said, uh-oh.
Wait, is that true?
No. Well, then, so it raises the question, if the expanded welfare state is not the answer, how, and I think it is not. I think the American people discovered, and Proposition 13, I think, was one of the first things. Now, I'll be willing to, as a taxpayer, I'll give you more money for more schools if it leads to brighter kids. But if I give you more money and the kids get dumber, then it doesn't take me very long to say, hey, I don't want to give you any more money. So sooner or later, that more money is in a bureaucratized system is not it. That doesn't mean, though, that we cut back services. But do we think of new ways of making services our work effective?
Because I think welfare system is the same way. I would say the conservatives probably feel that the people on welfare are just lazy and they ought to get out and work. And maybe some of them should, but I would guess that the average person on welfare can't work for various reasons. But I think that, at least working with the welfare system in Washington, D.C., I would say that the bureau is really top-heavy. The bureaucracy and the people down here weren't getting any of this.
You're right.
That's
in, I think it was in the mid-70s, I saw the research was done then, but it said New York City for, and they define poverty in a certain way, for poor families is spending $7,000 per person, per poor person. And a family of four, that was $28,000. And that was going, they said, you know, supposedly we gave that family $28,000, let them get their own housing and health care and that, which they, that would make them middle class. But instead, we've kept them poor, and that $28,000 goes into these programs, which, and so I'm not saying spend less, that may be the way to a welfare program would be an income distribution, a negative,
guaranteed annual income.
So that people, then you get away from this whole middle structure of trying to shape up the deviants down at the bottom so that they fit in. You would no longer label them as deviant. The thing that they don't have is any money. That's why they're poor. We say they're poor because they're unskilled, or they're poor because they have low ego development, or they're poor because of something that we can help them with. And maybe they just happen to be poor because they don't have any money.
Then the next thing you have to do is establish some kind of a system of people who can teach them how to use their money.
Uh-huh.
Because they don't know how to do that.
Financial advisor. Uh-huh.
We don't talk about revamping the welfare system, and obviously that's what is needed, but how is this done? That's the problem then.
Oh, well, you'd have to find ways of being subversive, I suppose, because the welfare system and all the systems have been instituted. Maybe. No, the church has done this for years. They take care of people. I mean, people know, I'm told about the church in the 30s, during the Depression, before they began to take care of people.
Mm-hmm. I think they could be better distributors of the money than bureaucracy. I mean, even with the government now, so they got to cut back on giving money to these programs, but where did they cut back? On the people, not on bureaucracy.
Yeah, that's right.
And if you're talking about efficiency, I mean, where we learn about efficiency these days, it seems, is from business schools, from corporations, in a surprising way, because they're concerned primarily about profit. Now, if we could steal some of that stuff, I think what has happened is that the institution as an institution in the past five years especially has really been gutted. There have been a lot of firings in big businesses in order to sort of streamline things, and people have lost jobs. Now that's a problem because in general, when you talk about communities caring about themselves, you don't have this overarching sort of planning mechanism which says, okay, we're going to, here in U.S. Steel in Pittsburgh, this is no longer profitable. Company is losing money. We're not going to be a welfare company, and just bite the dust. We're going to keep our stockholders, and so we're firing this. We're closing this factory, and that's the problem with just community developing is that it doesn't necessarily have an eye to what's going to happen when we get these people out of the institution. So the institution becomes effective. What are we going to do with all these unemployed teachers now in the city of Chicago, or unemployed administrators or whatnot who just don't have a place?
Yeah.
Those are difficult questions, okay. But I think they have to be asked at the same time.
And I suppose that on this side, efficiency doesn't become a major category. I mean, and development and planning. I suppose the Quiche village, they don't want to grow. They don't want to export products. They don't want to develop. They don't want to be efficient.